Hello and welcome to Plymouth Beneath the Surface, where we will meet inspiring people from Plymouth that have oriented their lives and careers around the ocean. Are you ready to dive into Plymouth waters to explore career options, discover underwater ecosystems, understand marine research and conservation initiatives? I'm your host, Ruza Sihan, a final year student in marine biology at the University of Plymouth. I'm really grateful to have you here today, and I hope you enjoy this dose of inspiration in this new episode.
So welcome to this second episode of Plymouth Beneath the Surface podcast, and I'm with Mark. Thank you, Mark, for being with us. Can you introduce yourself,
please? Yes, thanks, Louise. So my name is Mark Parry. I am a Plymouthian. I was born in Plymouth, and I've remained in Plymouth for much of my life. And I'm fortunate to be employed by the Ocean Conservation Trust at the National Marine Aquarium within a sort of conservation project.
Cool. So what did you study? Did you study here in Plymouth?
I did. So I came back to university at the age of 22 or 23. I was the first person in my family to study at university. So when I came back from spending time overseas, I suppose it was an unusual thing for me to do. When I was younger, I sort of planned on being or had aspirations of being an electrician or a fireman or a policeman. And I didn't really think that I would end up in ocean science or marine science. So at the age of 22, I came back. I hadn't studied my A-levels at school. I entered a access course, the extended science access course, which was the sort of route way into various marine science projects or science degrees. The only thing that wasn't available to us at that time as extended science students was marine biology, which is completely off the cards. So we could think about applying for various different degrees beyond extended science, but the pursuit of marine biology was not open. So I didn't imagine that I'd end up ever working in this field either. So I studied 12 months of extended science, which was a base fundamental course in chemistry, biology, and physics. And throughout that course, it came apparent to me the way that I wanted to take my life. And what I was interested in studying was at the time, the very new and exciting surf science and technology course. There were two or three of us that went from extended science on to surf science. And I think at the time, the university made it clear to us that extended science students that went on to degrees within Plymouth actually did quite well, because it was a sort of opportunity to get your head into studying space. And it actually turned out to be very much like two first years. So there wasn't a huge amount of responsibility or there wasn't a huge amount of emphasis on assessment. But it did prepare us and it did put us in the space that we were like sponges and ready to learn. So I studied surf science and technology for 3 years. And after that, I ended up working within the surfing industry for 7 years.
And so how did you jump from working in the surfing industry to now being working with the Ocean Conservation Trust?
So I suppose over the course of that surf science degree, what we all understood to be surfing was garment manufacture for Quicksilvers and Billabongs. And that actually isn't surfing. It's garment manufacture and fashion. So when I left, I ended up getting involved in surf coaching and then ended up sort of quite heavily involved with the British Surfing Association. So I worked there within sort of various training capacities, and I did have the opportunity to get involved in sort of grant procurement. And I think I got to 30 and I was still working for the Surfing Association. And it was one of my aspirations in my 20s to spend a significant amount of time at sea. And I remember being 30 and thinking, that's it, I've missed my opportunity to spend any time at sea. With that, I suppose I sort of thought about retraining or taking on subsequent postgrad degree. the activity of surfing and the sport side of surfing is a reasonably young person's sort of career path, isn't it? I sort of looked at and thought, this isn't going to see me through to my 50s or 60s or even to retirement. So I thought I'd go back to Plymouth Uni and I'll do a part-time master's in applied marine science. My employer at the time was happy to support me in that. I was sort of partly working from home, partly working from the office down in Cornwall. And I quickly, even before I'd finished my degree, I started getting job offers to go and be involved in environmental assessments for oil and gas construction and some of the environmental mitigation. So whilst I was doing this part-time master's, and I was still involved in surfing in some ways, I suppose where my primary job was actually offshore. So not only was I retraining, but I also fulfilled this desire that I never thought I was ever going to be able to do, to spend significant time at sea. We did sort of environmental mitigation and habitat assessments and environmental baseline surveys for oil and gas, whether that be construction or exploration. I was fortunate in the sense that at that time of my career, the offshore industry was very busy and it was constantly looking for sort of freelance marine scientists. So I'd go and provide that provision to the oil and gas industry. And I must have been doing that for about 7 years. Got slightly fed up with being away all the time. Out of 12 months, I probably spent 7 months away from home. Then I looked to get involved in, or just find a job back in Plymouth, which is where I've always lived, where my family lives, where my friends are. There was a job at the National Marine Aquarium that was advertised for what appeared to be the delivery of a project looking at seahorses and distribution of seahorses around the south coast. And the habitat that's closely associated with seahorses is seagrasses. So I went along to the interview and it turned out that the aquarium hadn't actually procured the funding for the project. This is where I guess something from my previous line of work, surfing, came in. I have been involved in the development of a successful grant. I potentially could do this just because of some of the ways that I operated at sea. I understood the fiduciary duties of reporting and budgets and whatnot. The National Marine Aquarium employed me for 12 months to put together a Heritage Lottery Fund bid for a seahorse project. Throughout the development of that, I sort of quite quickly realised that using an umbrella species for buy-in for the habitat is not really the significant point, it's the actual habitat itself. So we turned that project round into a citizen science project that predominantly looked at the habitat and got people engaged and offered opportunities to go and look at seagrasses and learn about their significance. So that's how I ended up working at the ocean. Well, the National Marine Aquarium was operated by the National Marine Aquarium, which is the charity. And that was quite a complex thing to communicate through grant writing, that we were involved in all sorts of other things apart from just running an aquarium. The Ocean Conservation Trust, or the National Aquarium at the time, was running a grants program that was overseas. It was involved in various sort of educational objectives and behavioural change aspects. So we sat down a couple of years ago and said, well, the National Marine Aquarium as a charity doesn't actually represent what we holistically do as an organisation. So we decided to change that name to something more representative of what we did, which was the Ocean Conservation Trust. So that's the core charity. And one of the assets that it runs is the National Marine Aquarium, but all other projects are run under the Ocean Conservation. So the OCT uses the aquarium to communicate its message.
Okay, so when you buy a ticket to the aquarium, the money goes to charity, a part of it.
That's correct, yes. So as you turn up as a visitor and you pay your admission fee, then it is going towards a charity. Obviously, you have to take out the running costs of that facility, the aquarium, and the running costs are quite substantial. But anything left over then goes towards a charitable mission.
So how long have you been working at the OCT now for?
Well, let's call it the NMA and OCT. Yeah. It's been about 7 years, I think.
Okay.
So when I started there, it was a 12-month contract. And then we were successful in the procurement of the Heritage Lottery Fund grant. And then after that, they have, in their wisdom, decided to just sort of keep me around. And so I try and develop funding bids. And that is it's quite a hard sort of thing to do because not all of them are successful. So you sit down as a team, you sit down as a group, you develop these ideas, you sort of buy into it. It's a bit like writing a job application. You think it's brilliant, you've got all the bases covered, and then you put in a huge amount of work collectively to get this application in. And then if it's successful, then obviously that's brilliant. But if it's unsuccessful, you get a paragraph back saying, thanks very much for your submission. However, we've not deciding to fund this project for a few reasons. So you've got to be pretty resilient, I think.
So the main project you're involved in right now is the seagrass restoration project?
Yes. So the Community Seagrass Initiative was a project that was established through the Heritage Lottery funding. And that had various different sort of elements to the project. We worked with all sorts of stakeholders and partners within that project. And when that funding came to an end, Natural England looked at the outputs and what we'd managed to achieve collectively within the stakeholder delivery. There was a little bit more that we could do. So there were some colleagues at Natural England that decided to apply for additional funding or funding from the European Life Programme, and we assembled some of the same stakeholders, some of the same delivery partners, and some new ones that might be able to create greater reach, to which the OCT stepped forward and said, well, okay, we will, what areas are we potentially going to be best at here? So we contribute towards the education side of that. And that's not only school education, but adult education and also the restorative efforts. So the project is looking to restore 8 hectares of subtidal seagrass bed within special areas of conservation. So Natura 2000 sites, because they fall under the remit of the EU Life Programme. So we are looking to restore 4 hectares in Plymouth and 4 hectares in Solent Maritime, and through a couple of different sort of approaches and a couple of different methods, predominantly through seed collection and then broadcasting them or seeding them at a time that is more suitable, that they'll stay in the seed bank and they've got a better chance of surviving within that in the seed bank rather than getting washed away. And also that we would try and germinate seedlings within lab space. So we're creating the ideal situation for these plants to grow. And then we transplant juvenile plants or seedlings into the environment. So which decreases the chance of
mortality, I guess.
Yeah, that's the plan. So great. We're working on that now for 3 years. We've collected 700,000 seeds over the course of 2020, and we'll put those out in spring 2021.
Okay, great. When Plymouth are you restoring seagrass?
So the target site that we've identified with Natural England will be in Jennycliff Bay, so to the eastern side of the Sound, if you look at chart. And there historically has been some records of it there, and there are a couple of patches, but that is our first target location. We don't see an enormous amount of anchoring in that region of the Sound. There is some to the northern side of the site, but hopefully there won't be a large amount of physical disturbance from the planting units that we put down. And the water quality there is very good. There's high sort of tidal exchange, so sort of keeps the plants clean from epiphytic growth. But then there's also the chance that our little planting units also get washed out. And it's also reasonably sheltered from wave action because it's behind the breakwater.
Are there sites where seagrass beds have been destroyed or where there's been quite an important loss of seagrass?
Yes. So the special area of conservation, which Plymouth Sound is, there is a condition assessment that takes place of certain features within that SAC. and seagrass is one of them. So when Natural England make that assessment, the aim is to keep that feature in favourable condition. So if it falls into unfavourable condition, then there needs to be an effort of management, or not as extreme as sort of restorative physical restoration. And that's where the life funding comes in. Much of the same seagrass is, from assessment of Natural England, falling into unfavourable condition, which means that it's in decline.
Do we know why? Is it water quality? Is it, like you said, anchoring?
I think it's multiple pressures. Probably the biggest one is people don't realise where it is and they don't realise its significance. The physical pressures would be excess nutrients from sort of runoff from agricultural land, leading to excess epithetic growth on the plant. There is a small amount of sort of slime mold wasting disease present, but not enough to significantly destroy or reduce the amount of coverage of the beds. Physical disturbance, as so anchoring. And so it's a combination of pressures. And where we see a decrease in water quality, we also see a decrease in water clarity. And it's a plant, so it needs to photosynthesize. But there are multiple sort of management tools in place to increase water quality, and they've done really well. Water Framework Directive. With the relief of some of those pressures, we're not seeing the seagrass return in the nature that we would want. And it's still overall in falling into worse condition than it was. So that's where this project looks to intervene and looks to offer positive concrete conservation solutions. We're within a sense tangibly, physically doing something about it.
You said people don't realize where it is and why it's important. Can you tell us why seagrass are important?
Why is seagrass important? Well, it provides a lot of services to the local community. It's very effective at stripping nitrogen from the water, so improving water quality and clarity. And when you look at the financial service of the meadows nitrogen stripping, it's considerably higher than the financial reward of some of the carbon stripping, but not many people are really interested in nitrogen stripping values of habitats, unless you work within water quality. There is the provision of nursery and habitat for juvenile fish. So it provides a place for our commercial fish to grow. And there is a large amount of study on what fish are using it as a juvenile habitat, the nursery habitat, how that impacts commercial fisheries. So without the nursery that we have for our commercial fisheries, then our commercial fisheries also get affected. So there's that financial benefit. There is the sediment stabilization sort of element of it, which as possibly as an ecologist isn't of great interest to you, but I didn't actually study ecology. I studied physics, physical oceanography. So that does interest me. Then there's also the carbon value as well. And where this all started for the National Aquarium and the Ocean Conservation Trust is it also provides habitat for some of our rarer, more endangered coastal species. There's a large focus upon carbon at the moment, probably rightly so, in the sense that opens up potential interest and funding to the restoration of the habitat. When you look at it as a whole, it is one of the most valuable ecosystems on the planet that not a lot of people really know much about. And I think the Costanza paper of 1999 sort of only looked at a couple of the ecosystem services values of seagrass and placed it within the top three sort of valued habitats ecosystems on the planet. So it's surprising that people don't know more about it.
Yeah, definitely. People are more and more aware of it, I think, but it's still not as sexy as corals, for example. It's still being seagrass and people don't really realise, I think.
Yeah, it's a homogenous environment, isn't it? So if you go diving on it, there's one bit of seagrass looks very much to the same bit of seagrass that's probably 1,000 metres away. But when you take into consideration what it's doing as a whole, and it's a primary producer, isn't it? It's the fundamental, the food chain, and all of those ecosystem services that I spoke about, there should be more of a media focus on it. And also, it has the ability to give quite a positive message about our marine environment, that it is in decline. However, you don't have to change the behaviour of 6.7 billion people to have an impact on it. You can work on a quite a localised scale to identify the pressure, to make an intervention that allows for the regeneration and restoration of this habitat. We can come out with some positive outcomes. For example, in the US, they've successfully managed to recreate over 200 hectares of Zostra marina bed within Chesapeake. We've got colleagues in Swansea that are successfully trying to replant areas of dale. There are projects within Scandinavia that are showing some success as well. So in a world of things that can be at times slightly depressing and slightly melancholy when you think about the loss of corals and the mechanism of that, then seagrasses on our doorstep is something that we can actually collectively as a community do something about.
Yeah, and you said like it's really tangible as well.
Yes, it does allow you to make this point of a concrete conservation action. So whereas it feels stopping some of the decline of coral reef loss is changing the behaviour of the whole planet, that we need to think about what our impact is on our CO2 outputs and what consequences that has on climate change.
Is the OCT working with local communities or agricultural people to work on this?
So within the team at the Ocean Conservation Trust, we have public engagement experts, and they do work within the community to bring about behaviour change. And we have colleagues within Natural England that are also looking to work within agriculture and its upstream thinking. So this idea that what enters our rivers effectively influences our coastal systems. So yeah, it is a holistic approach. We're not just working with one audience. We're trying to work with as many audiences as possible and to allow them to understand that we are connected to our environment and we're connected to the ocean, and the ocean is also connected to us. So there is a impact that we both have on each other.
And do you think Plymouth is leading the way in terms of marine conservation, or do you think there's more that could be done?
Plymouth is a great place to be a marine scientist in the sense that we have the Marine Biological Association, been there a very long time. We have Plymouth Marine Laboratories. We have the university and a lot of young, interested and excited people coming to look at the marine environment in Plymouth. And we, of course, have got the Ocean Conservation Trust and the National Marine Aquarium, which is a sort of big public engagement tool. So is it a good place? It is a good place, but I think it's a good place because the way that the environment is managed in Plymouth very seriously takes into consideration the marine environment. So within sort of the management structure within Plymouth City Council and the authority that manages Plymouth Sound, then the voice of science and the voice of conservation is heard just as loudly as anybody else's within that sort of group of stakeholders. Now, I can't sort of comment on other places around the UK, but it seems that Plymouth does approach its environmental obligations and its responsibilities very seriously. And I think that then supports the marine science industry or research when you have a management structure that is very serious about looking after its natural world, which also then brings sort of various opportunities for different organisations, doesn't it? As well, not only just biology, but also within oceanography and within technological development within Plymouth. So it's doing quite well. It's doing, I'd say, very well. There are always things that you could say that could be done better. And for someone that's working in an ecological field, I could say, well, this could be done better or that could be done better. But then in comparison, there will be people within the fishing community that would say, well, this could be managed better for our needs. And I think what Plymouth does is it looks at it holistically, it pragmatically listens to each stakeholder, and the marine science or the research element of that is just as valid as any other voice. So I think, yeah, it does do very well.
You said we're really connected to the ocean and the ocean is really connected to us. Is that how you feel and what you got to work in that environment is because you feel really connected to the ocean?
So growing up, we used to, during the holidays, we'd cycle from home up to the beach. And I think that's probably a similar story for many of the people that end up working in this field. There is a base sort of connection with the environment when you're a child, isn't there? And it's something that you value and something that you pursue throughout the rest of your life. So, yes, my family fortunately allowed me to interact with the ocean when I was a child. They gave me the freedom to explore it on my own as well. I think I taught myself how to swim at Bobbersand Beach by throwing myself in at the rocks at a small age. Whilst there wasn't any real plan to work in marine science or forge a career around the ocean, I think when decisions in my life came, I didn't necessarily think about what I was going to do in 40 years' time. I just thought about what was going to be right for me at that time. And subsequently, that has been staying in Plymouth, studying an ocean science, staying in the Southwest, being heavily involved in the surfing industry, returning to study at Plymouth to upskill through my master's, then going to sea. So at those, I guess, those pinnacle crossroads, whilst there's been no grand plan, just focusing on the here and now has always sort of led in the keep in touch with the ocean. I suppose that comes from the experiences that I had as a child, some of the bereavements that I had as a young person. The ocean was always there, and it doesn't judge, does it? It doesn't. It's a very great leveler. So it doesn't matter whether you are incredibly wealthy or poor. It's still the same environment, and it's still there are access issues, I suppose, if you're living in poverty, to some of the things that you can do. But it's a great leveler, and it doesn't really mind whether you are hugely academic or, as I say, sort of well off or not well off. It's just somewhere that combines all of us and pulls us all together. That's why I guess I stayed in it, really. It doesn't really judge. And staying within this field, you get an intrinsic reward from being in the environment. And I think that's, from what I understand, is created within a lot of people's lives when they're quite young. And that intrinsic reward then turns around and says, well, what can I do as a career? What can I contribute? And if that's driving your decision to stay involved in this line of work or something to do with the ocean, whether it's ecology, whether it's boat building, whether it's diving, whether it's marine surveying, you then, if you're contributing towards looking after something that you care about, then you spend more time in that environment. So it's sort of a loop of intrinsic rewards. So people have a tendency not to move away from it. Whilst I'm being asked to contribute towards the line of work that I'm being asked to contribute towards, I will keep doing that. It's possible that I might one day be asked not to contribute, in which case I'll go and think about going to do something different. You know, it's not, there isn't a grand plan. It's just, well, okay, what do I need to do now? I did both of my degrees in Plymouth, and the university and the qualifications that it has provided to me has been hugely beneficial to my career. So Plymouth's got a lot going on in it. It's a great city. The coastline's beautiful. You can access the moorland. You can access the rivers. You can, and I guess if you're thinking about coming to study in Plymouth, then you would make a good decision if you can.
Well, thank you, Mark, for being on the episode.
No problem. It's nice to meet you as well.
Thanks for listening to Mark and I. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you've learned a bit more about seagrass meadows in Plymouth, why they are important, and also what we can do to protect and restore them. And if you're interested in the project, there's more information in the description. Keep your eyes open for the next few episodes, and in the meantime, please take care of yourself and of the ocean.